Hello, and welcome to Business Talk, brought to you by Business West and sponsored by People's Bank. Hi, I'm Chris Kellogg from the Kellogg Crew Morning Show on 94.7 WMAS. And I'd like to introduce the host of this week's episode. He's the editor of Business West. Here's Joe Bednar.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Business Talk. We've got a great show for you today. But first, we have this important message from our sponsor, People's Bank.
Thank you for listening to the Business Talk podcast, sponsored by People's Bank, bringing you the best in business experts, entrepreneurs, and evangelists. Make Business Talk your innovation break for ideas and inspiration. People's Bank, where commercial banking can fuel your growth and make work life easier. Member FDIC, DIF Equal Housing Lender. Bank at peoples.com/business.
Okay, we're back. And as promised, we have a great show for you. Our guest is Dr. Andrew Lamb. He's a retinal surgeon with New England Retinal Consultants. He operates at Bay State Medical Center. He's also an assistant professor at UMass Medical School and an award-winning author. Happy to have you here on Business Talk.
Thanks a lot, Joe. Happy to be here.
Andrew, I'm going to circle back to your medical career and how your writing career developed from there. But I want to start with your most recent work, your fourth book called Masters of Medicine, which examines the history of modern medical breakthroughs in areas like cardiology, infectious disease, cancer, even childbirth, by telling the stories of the mavericks who made those breakthroughs, make those breakthroughs possible through persistence, genius, maybe sometimes a little luck.
Definitely.
And sometimes using questionable methods.
Sometimes mistakes.
Exactly. Tell me a little bit about how this latest work came about and what interests you about it.
Yeah, great question. You know, I had written a book called Saving Sight about my own story as a surgeon and the heroes of ophthalmology. And that book was relatively successful. And ever since that book came out about 10 years ago, people had said, you know, you should do that for all of medicine. You should talk about the unsung medical heroes who aren't well-known but really deserve to be. In the meantime, I got passionate about writing novels, so I wrote a couple of World War II novels. But during the pandemic, you know, like a lot of doctors and maybe first responders, I was having to go see patients. So I was, of course, terrified of bringing COVID home to my family. So I would actually semi-quarantine myself for several weeks. I remember doing this. You remember at the time we were like washing down our takeout containers. We didn't know anything about this. We didn't know very much about the virus. So I was kind of sitting in this guest bedroom for many, many days with all this time on my hands that I didn't really have before. And during this time, I, of course, binge watched a ton of TV like everybody else. But after I was, you know, maybe in the middle of Tiger King, I was thinking, gosh, maybe I could do something more productive with my time. And I said to myself, I said, I'm going to start reading about medical history. And I started reading about the history of cardiology. And I was a pretty arrogant ophthalmologist in the sense that I thought we had the best stories of incredible perseverance, serendipity, and medical discoveries. But boy, cardiology had great ones. And then I learned about the discovery of insulin. And it was such an incredible saga of like these co-discoverers who basically loathed each other so much that I'll just tell you one little tidbit of that story. One of them almost refused his Nobel Prize because he was so mad that his co-discoverer was also going to get one. That's the kind of drama, intrigue, and jealousy and envy that typified that discovery. And I was just hooked. I said, wow, I just started reading about all these different discoveries in medicine. And that was the impetus for me to write this book. And I really probably came about because I had more time to do research during the pandemic.
You mentioned a couple of interesting stories there you touched on. What are a few of your favorite stories from your research, the things that really kind of gave you the wow?
Oh, yeah, there are so many. So one, of course, I think is the discovery of penicillin, first because of how much it helped mankind, but also because, you know, history seems to have rewarded the wrong person for this breakthrough in many respects. You know, very briefly, many people know Alexander Fleming was one of the most famous doctors of the 20th century, but he didn't actually invent penicillin and develop it as a medicine. The real heroes of this story were these three Oxford scientists who were basically robbed of the credit they deserved. You know, in 1928, Fleming was a microbiologist who noticed like this wayward mold had landed on a bacterial culture of Staphylococcus, and the bacteria near the mold were dead, and he noticed this. And it was a very serendipitous finding. And he wrote a paper about it, but he didn't really do anything about it. 10 years later, these three scientists at Oxford, Howard Florey, Ernst Chain, and Norman Heatley, they read this paper and decided to see if they can make this penicillium mold into a useful antibacterial medicine. And this was a multi-year saga that overlapped World War II, had many ups and downs. And over time, they actually did it. And this led to the mass production of this miracle drug that helped a lot of American soldiers in the South Pacific during the war, et cetera. So when reporters started to write stories on this medical miracle, they went to go interview Fleming and also the team at Oxford. But whereas Fleming kind of looked the part of this white-haired, elderly, brilliant scientist, and he was happy to give interviews and kind of enjoyed the limelight, Howard Florey, who led the Oxford team, thought it was unethical for scientists to do anything that could be remotely considered self-aggrandizement. So he was cool to the press and really disliked being interviewed. And reporters basically stopped talking to him. And they started, just because it was easier, crediting Fleming, who again fit the perfect public image of what the public thought should be kind of what a pioneering genius scientist should look like. So again, that's just one of the great stories full of intrigue and serendipity and drama.
What was your process like? I saw, you know, in the back of the book, that, I mean, the bibliography is huge. You must have done a lot of research to kind of bring this all together, right?
I did. And I was lucky to be a part of Bay State Medical Center, which is a part of UMass Medical School. In this day and age, boy, research is so much easier than it ever has been. You know, I did a lot of historical research in college, and I was going down to the microfiche and the bowels of the library. And it was just crazy trying to find stuff. So now I can email the librarian at Bay State and ask for a scientific report from like Joseph Lister in the mid 1800s. And within a day, a PDF of that article, maybe from the Glasgow Surgical Journal, 1850 something, will show up in my email. And it's amazing. I mean, one of the advantages I had in writing this book was that I'm a physician, so I understand the language of medicine. I can literally read 200-year-old medical reports and understand what they're saying in a way that perhaps other historians or journalists at a deeper level, I can understand it. So it was a real thrill for me to read about these first-person accounts, basically, scientific reports of people trying to figure out antisepsis, anesthesia. Even like, for example, the assassination of James Garfield, a U.S. president, who basically was shot in the back by an assassin, but it really wasn't the bullet that killed him. It was the lack of antisepsis. People were examining his back wound with their unwashed fingers and unsterile probes, and it was horrible. But there were all these day by day, hour by hour medical reports as they care for the president, and you could just see their ignorance and their tactics and where they were misguided. So it was a great experience doing the research. I love that part of the process.
You know, I perused some of the book myself, and I've read a lot of reviews online because I wanted to see what people thought about it. And they really respond to a couple of things. One is that you're taking, and I think you mentioned, you touched on this a little bit, this medical jargon, which you understand, but you write it in a way that lay people understand it. It's very clear. And you're also, it's not just, a litany of dry medical history, but you're telling the stories of the people, not just what they did, but also their relationships, their personalities, their flaws. And I just think people really respond to that, learning about these things in that way through the people and not just through what they did. So was it fun to learn those stories and kind of weave the narrative around them?
Absolutely. You know, the most surprising thing about the research wasn't really the discoveries as much as the human fallibility, the faults of the co-discoverers or the incredible mavericks who discovered these things, because they're just as human as the rest of us. Like I mentioned, the discoverers of insulin and how they were envious and seeking credit. And the same is true of many, many other stories. For example, rivalries between doctors like Robert Koch and Louis Pasteur, who in the 1800s would basically excoriate and insult each other in public through articles and even at medical meetings, where one guy would be at the podium and the other guy's literally in the first row and they're just insulting each other. Another 20th century rivalry was between Jonas Salk and Albert Sabin in the race for the polio vaccine. And it was an ironic situation because humanity basically can benefit from rivalries like this, but they really disliked each other. Like Sabin would criticize Salk's vaccine and his approach, even after Salk's vaccine had already come out first and saved thousands of lives. He would literally go like before Congress and testify that this vaccine isn't good, as good as mine's going to be someday, you know? So that human element, I think, is crucial to make an interesting story. And I tried to fill the book with plenty of those.
Yeah, I think I said at the beginning, it's a, you know, I use the word sloppy, not for the writing, obviously, but it's a, but the history itself, it's not a clean line. It's not just, you know, one great advance after another. It is those flaws, those rivalries, those mistakes, and it's just all the sloppiness that goes into, you know, creating what eventually is just genius breakthroughs to change lives.
I mean, when your rivalry causes you to try to out-discover your nemesis or your rival, boy, humanity can definitely benefit. We, for example, with the polio vaccine, it was developed very quickly because of that. And we got two great vaccines because of that.
You're listening to Business Talk, a podcast presented by Business West and sponsored by People's Bank. We're talking today with retinal surgeon, professor, and author Andrew Lamb. Now, back to the beginning, you majored in history at Yale, is that correct?
That's right. I love history.
So what drew you into that? I mean, that's clear, but what drew you into that discipline to begin with? And then what factors kind of played into your eventual turn in a different direction into the medical field?
Thanks. So I grew up in Springfield, Illinois, kind of ironic for us now because I live in near another Springfield. So I just can't seem to get away from the Springfields. But Springfield, Illinois was full of history. You know, it was Abraham Lincoln's hometown. And my father was a cardiologist there. And even though I was that kind of kid who loved history, I would go to the library in the summers and have a goal of reading every history and biography book on the shelf by the end of the summer. I just loved going to battlefield. It was like going to Disneyland for me if we went to a Civil War battlefield. But every once in a while, I would be walking around my hometown with my parents or just by myself sometimes, and an elderly stranger might come up to me and get down on one knee at my level and say, "Are you going to be a great doctor like your dad? He saved my life, or he saved my mom's life, and she's right here," you know? And even though you don't, you know, you're always kind of skeptical about your parents, after you realize they're not perfect, you kind of think they're not that cool. But those kinds of experiences leave an indelible mark on you when you're a kid. And I knew being a physician could be a really fulfilling career. So, you know, I think I love what I get to do as a retina surgeon. I love trying to help people and doing everything I can to save sight. So even though I knew I would study history in college, I also knew pretty early on that I was interested in becoming a physician and a surgeon of some kind.
What do you enjoy most about that side of your life, as a retinal surgeon and a doctor? I mean, what's most gratifying to you?
It's a privilege. You know, there's a special feeling when you know you're trained to do something, frankly, that very few others can do. And since sight is so valuable to all of us, and the retina is such delicate gossamer neural tissue, you have to respect it. You'll be humbled the minute you think that you've mastered something and that you're doing really well. And then it just takes one situation, one case, one patient to humble you and realize that all you can do is your best, right? And it's an incredible privilege for patients to trust physicians like myself within minutes of meeting us. You know, I treat people with retinal detachments, diabetic retinopathy, macular hole, especially a condition called wet macular degeneration that many people who are elderly have and requires kind of repeated injection of medicine in their eye, believe it or not, we numb the eye, of course, to preserve their vision. And it sounds difficult, and in a way it is, but boy, is it worth it if the alternative is losing all your central vision.
Sure. You use the word, use the phrase saving sight before. It is the title of your first book. So when you, you've always been interested in history. You've always been a talented writer. Was it daunting to want to begin a first novel, and how did that book come about?
Yeah, my first novel was called Two Sons of China, and it was
that was before Saving Sight.
Well, it's a little mixed up, and I'll tell you why. I was sitting in my residency late one night in the ER, and I was kind of daydreaming, and I thought to myself, it's a real pity I can't share all the knowledge I gained in college about World War II and China, because that was what I studied. I did my thesis on that. I had learned a lot about the Flying Tigers, for example, and I felt like China, that theater of the war, was kind of an unmined aspect of World War II. Like, a lot of Americans didn't know what American servicemen and foreign service officers did in China during the war. And it was really important. Like, it was crucial to keep the Japanese in China and to help prevent the Chinese and Chiang Kai-shek's government from capitulating. Because if China capitulated, then hundreds of thousands of Japanese soldiers would then be freed up to fight the Marines in the Pacific. So it was really important to keep China in the war. And then I realized, you know, I was a busy resident learning medicine and I had kids. I didn't really have time to do the research and write a nonfiction book. But then I thought, what if I wrote a novel, like a dramatic, romantic, epic war novel? And that was my book, Two Sons of China. And I got an agent and I eventually got a book deal. But along the way, you know, there's a period when you have an agent, but you don't have a book deal. And when you have an agent, you basically spend all your time thinking, now what else could I write about? I have access to publishers and editors. So during that period, I said, wow, I'm a very historically minded ophthalmology resident. I know a lot of these amazing stories of the people who discovered the way we take out cataracts, do LASIK surgery. You know, people were even starting to implant retinal microchips to return some rudimentary sight to the blind. And so I just said, I want to write a book about the heroes of ophthalmology. And my agent said, that's not going to work. That's not that interesting. But I didn't want to give up because these stories were really great. And I said, well, what if I blended my own surgical memoir and took with those historical stories and brought the reader into the operating room to see what it's like to save sight, or sometimes more interestingly, what it's like to come up against a difficult complication in surgery and not exactly, frankly, know what to do. And it's terrifying sometimes. There's, you know, it's very stressful as a surgeon sometimes because you're trying to do everything you can. And that book, that idea made the book take off. And amazingly, that book, even though I wrote it second, got a book deal first and came out before my novel because gotcha. I've learned that nonfiction in some ways is less competitive than fiction. The fiction is a very competitive field for. So that's how those books came about.
I apologize for getting those rumors. I think I looked up the publication dates. That's why I had them switched. I didn't realize that the novel came first.
Well, it was written first, but it came out second. Yes, came,
written first. That novel is set as you said in the Chinese theater in World War II. Mm-hmm. Your second novel called Repentance is also set mm-hmm. in the World War II era. Tell me about that one.
Yeah, thanks. So I wanted to highlight the history of an incredible unit called the 442nd Regimental Combat Team in World War II, which was a segregated unit of Japanese Americans. And these men, many of them had families incarcerated in camps unjustly, like Manzanar, Tule Lake, and places people have heard of. And it was, and you know, this was part of the Japanese internments in camps during the war. And these men, to prove they were true and loyal Americans, fought with incredible valor and sacrifice in Europe, in Italy, and in France. They actually became the most decorated unit in U.S. military history per capita. And it's an incredible American story, and I wanted to help share that story with as many people as possible. And I did that through a novel. You know, I thought it was a good way for me to humanize them. And I was really gratified when it was a finalist for the Massachusetts Book Award in 2020. I hope and I believe that helped share that story with more people who weren't aware of it.
Have you got any response to either one to the novels from folks who might have a family history in that
definitely, in
those times
yeah.
and places? That and how gratifying is that?
It's the most gratifying part of the process, you know. So for the Repentance, the Japanese American novel, the novel was kind of highlighted by many Japanese American publications and places that people read, and it's still gratifying to get emails from people who say, my father or my grandfather was in the war, and now I understand more about what he went through. There were some incredibly, they're well known to people who know military history, battles and missions. The 442nd rescued the Lost Battalion in the Vosges Mountains of northeastern France. And their heroism, frankly, was a big factor in allowing Hawaii to become a state, because they had, it became their heroism. It was a situation in which they lost more guys than they saved. They sacrificed so many guys trying to save a group of Texan soldiers. And the Texans, the state of Texas was always very, very indebted to the Japanese Americans, many of whom were from Hawaii actually. And they supported, their senators supported Hawaii becoming a state. And this heroic story, which was picked up in the news, helped kind of turn the tide of public opinion, because Hawaii becoming a state was controversial because it would be a majority non-white state for the first time in our history. And so frankly, some people were against that. And I'll tell one more story. My novel, Two Sons of China, about World War II in China, centers on a real life mission called the Dixie Mission, where these American Foreign Service officers went to visit these northern Chinese, guerrilla fighters who seemed to be fighting the Japanese more effectively than the nationalists, who were kind of considered corrupt. And these guerrilla fighters were actually the communists in northern China, led by Mao. And there was a important Foreign Service officer named Jack Service who kind of led them. And unfortunately, he and his colleagues ended up losing their careers because during the McCarthy era, they were accused of being communist sympathizers, even though at the time in World War II, they were reporting honestly about communists who at the time, we didn't know they were going to be, tyrants. They appeared to be like agrarian reformers who were really interested in fighting the Japanese, which is what we wanted. And Jack Service's son, Robert Service, who was a U.S. ambassador to Paraguay in his career, reached out to me after he read the book and invited me to give a talk to State Department officials after that book came out, and retired Foreign Service officers. And that was a really, really gratifying experience.
Nice. Whether it's the nonfiction books or the novels, you're really doing a lot to preserve history in a lot of ways. Clearly you're passionate about it. Tell me kind of why is history such a passion for you? It seems to always have been, but why is that?
I don't know. I just was one of these kids who I look around at the world and have curiosity about how it came to be the way it is. I have a passion for history. I admire so many friends and colleagues who have other passions. Like, boy, when I was a kid, if I knew there were, I'd have so many friends who ran marathons, I'd be flabbergasted. Like, there are so many people who are passionate about youth sports and things like that. So for me, it's just writing and writing history. I think that my English teachers were probably a bit shocked that I became an author, because I was probably too immature to appreciate and understand literature when I was in high school. But it's really my passion for history and telling these stories that make me want to keep writing and share these stories.
Before we go, is there any other book project you have coming up, or are you still kind of thinking of ideas?
My wife really hopes I don't get any ideas, I think, because when I get an idea, I just disappear. It's kind of like, she calls it the other woman, basically, because if I get an idea, I just get so passionate about it. So I don't really have anything on the burner right now. I'm spending a lot of time promoting this last book, The Masters of Medicine. And it's been fun doing that because I love speaking to audiences and trying to share my passion for these stories with others. And I enjoy talking to you as well and sharing with your audience. So I appreciate the opportunity.
And people could find Masters of Medicine where? Bookstores, Amazon?
Yeah, any bookstore. It's online in every book vendor. It'll be in all bookstores. You can just Google the Masters of Medicine or Andrew Lamb and the Masters of Medicine, and it'll come up.
I encourage people to do that. It's really interesting. That's all the time we have for today. Thank you, Dr. Lamb, for spending some really interesting time with me today.
Thanks a lot, Joe. Appreciate it.
And thanks to all of you for tuning into Business Talk, a podcast presented by Business West and sponsored by People's Bank. I'm Joe Bednar, the editor of Business West, and we'll see you next time.